Good evening, listeners. This is Professor Jonas Armitage, and you're listening to Stories from Dark Places. If you're not familiar with our radio format, it's perfectly understandable. You see, out here in our cozy little valley in Innsmouth, our radio broadcasts don't always reach the outside world. But through an act of supreme engineering by our studio's technical advisor, Donato Cardenas, our broadcast antenna is up and at maximum strength. So, for the first time in quite a while, I look forward to sharing the evening and a story with you. Tonight, we will be visiting a spooky little tale from an internet author named Mr. Gator. The story is called Red Mole. I don't know how you feel about scary stories, but there's very few in this world that gets my heart pumping like a good scare. So I'm looking forward to it. I hope it's as good as it seems. That being said, please pardon me while I switch over to the appropriate feed, and I will join you momentarily with tonight's tale, Red Mole. I was never one for superstitions, but the events of the last few months have drastically changed my outlook on the cosmic forces at work in this world. It began last year when my best friend Lonzo and I had decided we'd had enough of our lives in South Florida and both pursued new careers in beautiful Butte, Montana. We'd been friends since we were kids, and neither of us was happy with where our careers were at age 25. Myself, a substitute teacher in the Miami-Dade public system, and Lonzo working construction after a serious knee injury had ended his chances of playing shortstop in the majors. We both had always loved the outdoors, along with our buddy Brian, who we called Brain due to his ridiculous intellect. The three of us had taken trips out west every summer since we could drive, trying to plan them around Lonzo's baseball schedule. There was something about getting off the grid for a week or two that grounded us and reminded us who and what really mattered in life. Spending hours drinking in scenic vistas and mountain air, waking up to the magenta sunrises and falling asleep under a night sky, that was unparalleled by anything city life back east had to offer. Though Brian would have loved nothing more than to join us in our elevated adventure out west, he was finishing up his PhD in molecular biology from the U of Miami and working full-time in one of the premier biolabs on the East Coast. Lonzo and I saved up for a few months as the school year ended, and I looked for teaching jobs in some scenic locations. Finding work for Lonzo wouldn't be a problem, so we based our destination on somewhere I could land a full-time teaching gig. We settled just outside of Butte. I had secured a position teaching American history and government to high school freshmen at a school about half an hour from downtown. Though we could afford to live in town, that wasn't why we'd made the move, so finding the perfect place to live was a major priority for us. After what seemed like days going through Craigslist and Realtor.com listings, we actually stumbled upon what we thought was the ideal place for us to rent in a newspaper ad of all places. 3-bedroom farmhouse on 35 acres, tucked into the Boulder Mountain Range north of Butte, read the ad. $850 a month plus utilities was a kicker for us. We could afford that on either of our paychecks, and it gave us plenty of opportunities to get into our nature. The location was only about a half an hour drive from the high school that I'd be teaching at, and 45 minutes from the drill site Lonzo had signed on to as a roughneck. I joked with him about how they call it a roughneck for a reason, and that he would spend 2 weeks straight at the site sometimes. And Alonzo said it couldn't be any worse than building high-rises in Coral Gables, and the money was way too good to pass up. Before we signed our lease, we met with our soon-to-be landlord to put down a deposit and check out the house. Henry Wilson looked to be in his late 40s, early 50s, with salt-and-pepper shoulder-length hair, a broad athletic build, and cold gray eyes. When he showed up, you could tell he wasn't used to dealing with minority populations, and Alonzo Ramirez was a 6'2" Afro-Cuban who stuck out like a bull on a dairy farm in the very, very white rurals of Montana. Nonetheless, Hank didn't seem to mind after the initial shock of meeting us. "You two are most certainly not from around here," Hank said, probably noticing my serious tan and Alonzo's obvious South Beach vibe. "You caught us, detective. We're on the run with stolen jewels and needed a place to hide out for a few decades." I don't think he appreciated my joke, but after I offered to buy the first round of drinks, he loosened up a bit. And both Lonzo and I thought it was odd he wanted to meet at a bar, and probably should have read this as a sign of the kind of landlord he was going to be, but the picture we'd seen and the description of the farmhouse was too good to pass up. After a few beers, he agreed to take us out to see the house, but insisted he drive. And a little reluctant, we agreed to hop into his 99 Silverado and ride out to what we hoped would be our dream home. Hank had an odd smell to him, not B.O. or anything like that, but a smell that reminded me of a football coach we had in high school who gave even the biggest, most badass linebackers the heebie-jeebies. "You boys are going to love the house. No one to bother you for a good 5 miles in any direction. One road in, one road out. Perfect solitude in a mountain paradise." Normally, the idea of this kind of place would have had me over the moon, but something about the way Hank said it made the hair on the back of my neck stand up and my skin crawl. We'd come out west for this exact reason, but now that Hank Wilson was driving us out to it, it seemed like the last place I wanted to be. Don't ask me how I knew, but Alonzo felt the same way. Between our tension and Hank's odd predatorial scent, you'd almost taste the fear in the air. The longer we drove, the more I felt as if this might actually be a trap. But I remember trying to come up with reasons for why we needed to go back to town, and Hank insisted we see the place and that it wasn't much further. It was at this exact moment I noticed that Hank, much like a high percentage of men in Montana, was packing heat. From the look of it, he had a Smith & Wesson 357 on his right hip. I recognized the model because my uncle had one as a service weapon in the Florida State Police. It didn't take long for Hank to notice both me and Alonzo staring at it. "Bears and coyotes," he said. "You'd be wise to invest in some type of firearm yourselves, though there's a good chance that if you put one in the wrong spot of a grizzly, it'll just piss him off." His joke actually lightened the mood a bit, and finally the house came into view. It wasn't as much a farmhouse as it was an old Victorian, sitting up on top of a hill tucked against the backdrop of some of the most beautiful country I'd ever seen. A grove of pristine pines, lush with needles and as dense as a swarm of bees, not 50 yards from the back deck. The house itself reminded me of the Marston House from Stephen King's Salem's Lot. But I was hoping the location wasn't infested with vampires. Little did I know, the horrors that awaited me were far more terrifying. Hank gave us the full tour, explaining that old places like these were way out here in the woods, and they had a few important rules. The first was don't use the fireplace, as it worked, but it was far too great a risk of a house built from Douglas firs in 1892. Second was that we couldn't change any of the original woodwork, paint the walls, or remove wallpaper. Nearly everything was original to the house, and the owners hoped to restore it and sell it one day. Third was that the internet and cell service were spotty at best, but that there were a couple of cafes in the nearby town of Rockwood that had free Wi-Fi. Last was the basement, off limits to tenants. The owner still had several things of value there, and Hank would have to come out and transport from time to time, so they should also expect to see him there a decent bit. All things considered, the place was amazing. It felt like something out of another time period, and the fact that it still had a lot of the old-school charm and furnishings, not to mention the pictures of what we assumed were long-dead former family members, still on the walls, gave it a friendly and macabre mystique. We thanked Hank for showing us around and asked him how soon until we could move in, and he told us as soon as our deposit check cleared, we could start moving things in. We went back to our hotel and called Brian to let him know the great news. "Brian, this place is amazing," I told him excitedly. "Yeah, amigo, you should absolutely love it," Alonzo chimed in from the bathroom. "I've told you guys a million times to stop calling me Brain," he chuckled. "Only joking." "And whatever you say, Brain," Alonzo and I said in matching sarcastic replies. "I can't wait to come check it out. Maybe right before school starts up or during your fall break. Things are just a little crazy at the lab right now," he said with some resentment. I could tell he wanted to be on the adventure with us, but he was living his dream, and we were happy for him. "I'll give you a call when we're all moved in. Oh, if we have the service. That is, the place is super remote. Just be careful, guys," he said to us with a twinge of caution in his voice. "You don't have Big Brain Brian out there to keep you two goons out of trouble." "And we'll be just fine, buddy," I said, not realizing how incredibly wrong I was. A few days later, we were moving in the few things that we'd brought with us and getting the lay of the land. Alonzo and I did a couple of day hikes right from the property and knew we had come to the right place. The terrain was awe-inspiring. White-capped monoliths covered with thick green forests, mountain streams so clean you could drink directly from them, and the sunsets could melt away any fear we'd previously thought about having this move. We wanted to get some fun in before Alonzo had to spend 2 weeks at the rig site, hoping a big strike would net him an early bonus. After about a week of checking out what the town of Rockwood had to offer, as well as some of the best local trails and waterholes, it was time for Alonzo to head out to the rig. We'd used some of our savings to buy him a beat-up Ford Ranger he could use to get to and from. This way, we both had a vehicle out here. "Let me know when you get there. Maybe you'll have a better cell service than I do now." "They better. My damn Pornhub app better be working too, otherwise I'm going to have to go analog and buy me a Playboy," Alonzo said, completely serious. "Shit, do they even make nudie mags anymore?" "I don't know, bud. Hefs is dead, so who knows." That first night alone in the house was when I started to notice some strange goings-on. I was laying in bed, doing some prep work for my upcoming classes in the fall. We still had a good 2 months before the school year started, but I wanted to really be prepared and knock it out of the park this first year. I was in the middle of typing up a lesson plan on the rights of citizens protected by the First Amendment when the power went out through the house. I thought it was particularly odd that my laptop, which had been at over 60% charge, also died on the spot. I looked at my phone and had no service, but at least it provided me with some light. I hadn't noticed how quiet it got in the house at night, and it seemed like every little blow of the wind would weave its way through the floorboards and bring the house to life. It was then that I heard the scratching for the first time. It began subtly, almost like a whisper, and I originally blamed it on the wind, but the longer it went on, the more distinctive it got. It was getting louder, and it seemed to be moving around the downstairs. "You're just being a pussy," I told myself. "First night alone in an old house, and you're letting your imagination get the best of you." But then, the scratching became even louder. I made my way to the bedroom door using the light on my phone, and I thought about calling Lonzo. But again, I had zero bars. As I opened my door and peered down the hallway, I saw nothing but darkness. I shined the phone flashlight down the hall, and for a minute, the scratching seemed to have stopped. And as soon as I'd finally made pride with the fact that my mind was playing tricks on me, it started up again. At this point, my heart was pounding between my ears, and I was having trouble focusing, but I knew where the scratching was coming from. I slowly made my way down the stairs and was standing at the basement door, and it was louder now. It was coming from the basement. Normally, this is where I would turn and run to my 2012 4Runner parked outside and never look back. But for some reason, I knew I had to see what was making the noise. I approached with caution, and almost as if the higher powers wanted me to give them a show, my phone died. No light, no weapon, and no one to save me. I slowly made my way to the basement door and peered down the steps below. It was black. Impossibly black. Through the darkness, it almost seemed alive. I could make out something moving below. I tried to get a better look into the darkness, even if it was just to put a face to the creature that was about to end my sorry excuse of a life, but I couldn't make out anything more than a shadow figure from where I was at the top of the stairs. I tried to move down the steps as quietly as I could, the shadow beast not more than what I thought 5 feet below me. I got to the third step down and slipped, barely catching myself on the railing, before receiving a face full of bright light. "Jesus fucking Christ, Hank! What the hell are you doing here in the middle of the night?" "Sorry, bud. Came out here with the weatherman predicted high winds," he said, as calm as a lamb. "This place frequently blows a fuse when the winds kick up and put pressure on the power lines. I was trying not to disturb you, but from the look of it, I did more than that." "Yeah, I would say so," I said, annoyed. "Maybe I wouldn't be wound so tight if you hadn't been scratching the damn walls down here." "What are you talking about? I was just messing with the fuse box. I wasn't scratching anything." Hank was becoming annoyed himself. "You didn't hear the scratching a few minutes ago?" "I heard it all the way up in my room," I said, slightly out of breath. I didn't realize how worked up I'd gotten. "I have no idea what you're talking about," Hank said as he put a tool back on his belt. It looked like a small chisel, which wouldn't have made much sense for fixing a fuse. "What the hell is that?" I exclaimed, pointing to what looked like a dark red claw mark that ran across the wall. Hank examined it with his hand, touching the marks, and then touched his hand to his mouth as if to taste it. It's mold. Places like these, unfortunately, it's a price you pay for the rustic atmosphere. It's dark red! What kind of mold is dark red? I could tell Hank wasn't in the mood for explaining himself, and fell back on the rules of the house. And he explained that my ass was not supposed to be in the basement. And that though he himself would be there frequently, on this occasion, he was out here trying to be a good landlord. After a few minutes of posturing and deciding who was right, Hank packed up and headed out. The power was back on, and I actually had service for a change. After I saw Hank's headlights make their way off the property and back towards town, I went back to the red mold on the wall of the basement stairs. I touched it and was surprised at its consistency. It was almost like a gelatin, or some type of ooze, more than a plant. I'm no botanist, but this was nothing like any mold I'd ever seen before. And the fact that it was on this wood, ingrained in what looked like scratch marks from fingers, or better yet, claws, made it even more bizarre. Not to mention unnerving. Though I didn't know what it was, I took a picture, and I sent it to my other best friend in the world. Hopefully, Big Brain Brian would shed some light on the situation for me. But unfortunately, I'd have to wait for answers, because as soon as I was able to send him the photo, I lost service again. After a nearly sleepless night, I woke with the dawn the next morning and decided to do a little investigating around the house. I went back downstairs. I noticed Hank had placed a padlock on the basement door. One of those old industrial ones you'd see in old movies on the gates of a dilapidated old mansion covered in ivy and moss. I lifted it up, and its weight was substantial. I decided it wasn't worth my time or the possible conflict with Hank to mess with it any further. As I made my rounds of the first floor, I noticed some of the old photos on the walls weren't as old as I thought. Some actually seemed to be pretty recent. There were a series of prints hanging in small frames from a small back stairway leading directly to the third floor, which was just an old storage space, likely full of asbestos. Nevertheless, these pictures were of what appeared to be a family of four. A middle-aged couple, their teenage daughter, and an adolescent son. The mother, I presume, looked oddly familiar, but I couldn't seem to place her face. It was like seeing the ghost of someone you met in a past life. There was some recognition of something, but I didn't actually know. As I examined the photos further, I began to hear that scratching again. I thought my mind was playing tricks on me, and that maybe my lack of sleep was making me hallucinate. But sure enough, it was there. I made my way back to the cellar door, half expecting to see it ajar again with Hank getting up to who knows what. But it was locked, just as it had been before, and again, the scratching continued. I inched closer to the door, trying to hear if anyone was down there. But nothing. I moved closer and placed my ear to the old wooden door, cupping my hand around it to magnify any sound that may have been coming from the other side. There wasn't any scratching, but now there was a new sound. The sound of a woman whispering. I pushed my ear as close as I could to the door, trying to make out what she was saying. "Hello? Is someone down there? Do you need help?" The whispering stopped. My heart was pounding in my chest, and I could feel someone there. I couldn't be imagining this, but Jesus, what the hell was going on? I waited on bated breath for a response, but none came. And then all of a sudden, I had service again. "Yo, what's crackin', Montana Max? How's life in Big Sky Country? Brian, you have no idea how good it is to hear your voice. Things have been great, but also a little weird. Did you get that picture I sent you? Yeah, man. Really odd-looking mold. Never seen anything like it down here. That being said, I'm not super familiar with the flora of the mountains west. I was a bit surprised by the answer. Brian wasn't one to easily admit defeat in terms of something testing his intellect. Which is why what he said next made a lot of sense. So since I've never seen anything like it before, and neither have the colleagues I showed it to, you think you could mail me a sample? Mail you a sample? Why? Because you know I love a good mold mystery. No, jackass, because it's something I've never seen before, and you know how I get with plants. If it's something rare, I could include it in my current research. I paused for a few seconds before responding. All right, what do you need me to do? He explained the process to collect the sample and send it to him. I explained that I didn't just have a petri disc lying around, and he walked me through how I could use a Ziploc bag to make a pretty well-sealed sample. After collecting the sample, I told him I'd mail it next time I was in town, which I hoped would be the next day. We talked a little longer about how things were in South Florida. I told him about how our creepy-ass landlord made my skin crawl like Coach Carter. He told me he'd give me a call in a few days when he got the sample and offered to pay for the expedited shipping. He was really excited about the chance to study something he'd never come across before. And a couple days later, I decided to venture into the little hamlet of Rockwood. It was a pretty nice little town. It had a charm that only Western mountain towns can produce, this rustic vibe. But at the same time, modern America was moving in. It had plenty of coffee shops and cafes, and as Hank had mentioned, they advertised free Wi-Fi. There was a Starbucks, a couple other popular chain restaurants, at least half a dozen outdoor enthusiast shops, all within the 4 square blocks of downtown, quote-unquote. I was already familiar with the charming Mel's place from our first encounter with Hank, so I figured a second stop might be a good chance to find out more about the town and the house I was living in. I was more than a bit surprised to see almost a full crowd at the bar at 11 a.m. on a weekday. I guess Mel's is the place to be. I cozied up to the bar and ordered a Bloody Mary, when in Rome, and I asked the bartender if he knew anything about the property I was renting, and he didn't seem to have the slightest clue. But he did say that if anyone would know about the place, it'd be Lucille Enders, the local librarian. I finished my Bloody and left a nice tip and made my way to the Rockwood Public Library. To say Lucille Enders looked like a librarian would be a colossal understatement. A middle-aged woman with curly brown hair and a tight bun, half-moon glasses complete with chain, and a white-collared shirt poking out of a gray crewneck sweatshirt that read, and I shit you not, I love books. She had 3 different reference books open in front of her, consulting one, then the other, before jotting down some notes. And as I approached the front desk, I caught a whiff of her perfume, strong enough to gag a stripper. And when she noticed me approaching, she closed her books and slid them off to the side. Good afternoon. What can I do for you? She said as she covered the title of one of the books she'd been reading. The perfume made a lot more sense when I realized the title of the side of the book, The Kama Sutra. It didn't take long for me to realize this woman was on the prowl, and I must have been right in her wheelhouse because she was laying it on thick. After a few minutes of chit-chatting, she even showed me her favorite position from one of the other sexual manuals, as she called them. Truth be told, I thought about inviting her back to the house, which actually reminded me of why I was there in the first place. I explained where I was staying and asked if she knew anything about the place. And Lucille said that she was familiar with the house, and the last she knew of. There had been a family living there. She gave the impression that they lived very off the grid, and said they almost never came into town, but when they did, they always checked out books from the library. She said the parents got books on sustainable lifestyle and doomsday prepping, and that they were always very polite. And this is where things got a little spooky. Lucille said the family had disappeared a while back without a trace, and the police had gone out to the house and found no clue as to where they'd gone. Almost all of their things had been left behind, including the library books that they had left very well overdue. They searched for them in the nearby wilderness, but no one really knew them. And those that did didn't think it would be out of the realm of possibility for them to just pick up and go. She did say that they had an old Winnebago that they had sometimes drive into town, and that it wasn't left at the house, which is why the police didn't really search very hard to find them. All of it seemed a little sketchy. But this is what she knew. At the end of our conversation, I thanked her for the info and said maybe I'd see her around. She blushed and gave me her number in case I needed any more information about the town. As I made my way back to the house, I wondered about the woman I'd seen in the family picture, the one who I felt I recognized but couldn't quite place, and I wondered if she could have been the mother of this family that up and left town out of nowhere. That night, we had another pretty serious windstorm, and I wondered if Hank would be out again to fix the breakers. For hours, I laid in bed trying to ignore the sound of whispers in the walls. I blamed it on it being an old house, but I couldn't shake the feeling that I wasn't alone. The power kicked off with the high winds, so I occupied myself by working my way through the house, lighting several candles and a few kerosene lanterns that Hank had been kind enough to lend me after his last trip out. And once again, I found myself making my way down to the basement. In the glow of the lanterns, drawn by the sounds of the scratching. This could not actually be happening. I was a grown man letting a spooky old house and the disappearance of the previous inhabitants let my mind play tricks on me. I was so delirious I didn't even realize I'd walked all the way downstairs and was just a few feet away from the basement door. The scratching was louder now. I looked at the door and saw more of the red mold. This time, though, it resembled more of a handprint by the handle than scratch marks. It was at this point I heard the whispers again. This wasn't in my head. I was of sound mind and a rational man, and I was still convinced that there was someone or something whispering to me from the other side of the door. I had never been so afraid in my life. But at the same time, I couldn't run. I needed to know what was going on the other side of that door. My stomach twisted in knots. My palms were greased with sweat. I tried to gather my nerves and put my ear to the door. And the whispering stopped. It was replaced with a very distinct sound. The sound of human nails scratching into wood. I pulled back from the door and noticed the mold had begun to drip, which I didn't think was something possible of mold. I reached to touch the red handprint just below the handle when something that had been quite rare happened. I got service and received a text from Brian. "You must think you are really fucking funny, don't you?" I responded, "What the hell are you talking about?" I can't believe you would send me that shit in the mail, dude. Is it yours? Really made me look like a sick bastard at the lab." "Brian, I seriously don't know what the fuck you're talking about." "Human blood. You sent me human blood and said it was mold. I'm lucky I still have a job." It was at this point my phone again went black. The scratching was back and louder than ever. Each scratch now appeared streaking red through the door. Each streak of red now dripping crimson drops on my side of the door. And the whispers were back. Who are you? What do you want? I screamed at the door. I'm still not sure why I didn't immediately hightail it for the car and never look back. But something in me was screaming to break down the door and get to the other side. I was a man possessed, and though every inch of my being was screaming to run, run, and never look back, I was going to see this through. I went to the kitchen and grabbed a hammer from the tool drawer. I made my way back to the door and began swinging away. By the third swing, the padlock cracked and released its hold on the door. And as the door slowly crept open, what I saw sent a chill through me. Blood red scratch marks all over the walls of the stairwell, leading down to the cellar. The scratching and the whispers were coming from the other side of the wall. And at this point, I had firmly decided that I would not be getting my security deposit back, and started bashing into the plank board wall. Each second, more of the stairwell wall came down until I could start to make out something inside of it. And at this point, I was dripping with sweat, covered in debris and red mold, and praying that maybe at some point I'd wake up from this nightmare. And though I didn't have service, my phone flashlight still worked perfectly. I slid the hammer into my pocket, peered behind the drywall into the depth of the house itself, like peeling back its skin to see what made it tick. And what I saw is forever burned into my mind. And I'm not sure that there are enough therapists in the world to help me unpack the anguish of it all. It was a corpse. Or rather, it was several corpses. The closest to me was unmistakably a woman, and I knew exactly who it was from her floral dress, the same she was wearing in the framed picture upstairs. It was at this moment I remembered why I recognized her. It was her eyes. She had that same cold gray cast to her eyes as Hank. And I backed up the stairs in horror until I felt the blade work its way between my ribs. I see you've met my sister and her family, Hank whispered in my ear as the knife plunged deeper into my abdomen. I began to feel cold, and I felt myself slipping away. The last thing I heard was Hank whisper, "It looks like you're gonna have to be joining them." He threw me down the stairs, but thankfully I blacked out after the initial contact. And when I came to, I was at the bottom of the stairs, soaked in what I imagined was half blood, half sweat. Hank must have thought I was already dead, because he'd already started patching up the wall. I'd been out a while. I watched him patching it, trying to plan my next move and figure out a way to survive this. Hank, thinking I was dead, gave me some element of surprise, but I'd lost a lot of blood. My legs had gotten pretty banged up in the fall. Even with age on my side, I was no physical match for him at this point. As I tried to figure out my options, I heard a familiar voice from upstairs. "Hola, amigo! Guess who's back with a fat paycheck from a big strike?" Lonzo. Hank stopped what he was doing and pulled the knife out from a holster on his hip and made his way to the top of the stairs. It took every bit of life I had left, but I crawled my way to the top of the stairs. I heard Hank talking to Lonzo, and Lonzo being concerned why there was no power. And after an excruciating climb, I reached the top of the basement stairs just in time to see Hank pulling the knife from behind his back. I managed a half-choked shout, "Lonzo!" He has a knife. And I was too late. Lonzo was quick to react, but Hank was already plunging the knife between his shoulder blades. Thank God Lonzo was a monster of a human being and managed to turn around and tackle his would-be murderer. And as I heard them struggle in the next room, I forced myself to summon every last bit of strength I had left to get to my feet. Lonzo and Hank must have knocked over a lantern because the living room had erupted into flames. My weight leaned against the wall, and I slid myself closer to the living room, watching the shadows dance across the wall as they exchanged blows. As I turned the corner and saw the extent of the fire, in the middle of the room, Alonzo struggled on his knees with Hank standing behind him, his hair in his right hand. They both looked as if they had gone 10 rounds with Apollo Creed. Alonzo saw me and mouthed the word run. It was almost as if everything began to make sense, because as he did, I heard the scratching again. Dot, dash, dot, R. U dash dot N. It was fucking Morse code. Hank removed his knife from Alonzo's back and dragged it across his throat, spraying hot crimson across the room. The flames had spread to the kitchen and were quickly enveloping the entire house. Hank released his grip on Lonzo and he dropped to the floor. My heart sank because my best friend was dead, and then he turned his sights on me. In death, Alonzo had given me a chance. Hank had a large gash across his forehead, which was dripping blood into his eyes, so he must not have been able to get a good look at me. I'm sure if it was rage or hate, the fact that he was a psychopath, murdering, lunatic, killed his family, I don't know what. But he charged me. And he didn't realize that I had the hammer. A few steps before he reached me, he raised the knife, ready to bury it in my skull. And although I had used up every last bit of my energy dragging myself up the stairs, I somehow found another wind, and I swung the hammer. And it was as if Lonzo was holding me up and guiding my arm. It made direct contact with Hank's jaw, and teeth and flesh flew across the room like candy from a piñata. His knees went limp and he hit the floor hard. I turned him over and looked him in his cold gray eyes. Jaw slack at the side of his face, gnarled in a jar, blood and drool spilling out. And even now, the hate in his gray eyes burned, and I swear they went from gray to red, just like the mold. "Go to sleep, you son of a bitch," I said as I buried another hammer thrust down, removing his jaw from his face. I dropped the hammer and dragged myself out of the house as the flames stretched into the second floor. I regret not pulling Lonzo out with me. But I knew that if I died in the house, he died for nothing. I made it out to the front yard, the house burning down behind me, its beautiful Victorian frame engulfed in flames. They poured from the windows. It was just as Hank had warned. The entire structure was feeding the blaze like ravenous hyenas taking down a wounded gazelle. It didn't take long before the entire structure collapsed in on itself. After a week-long recovery in St. James Hospital, I was transferred to a larger facility in Billings. The fire and police departments had a lot of questions for me, and I still think they suspect that I had more to do with the bodies they found than I let on. They were able to identify several bodies in the wreckage of the house, but due to the fire and the collapse, it was hard to tell anything from the remains. I was done with Montana. I needed to spend some time back with people I cared about, so I went back to Florida. My recovery has been a long one, and I've had to stay in touch with the Montana State Police because they were never able to identify the body of Hank Wilson. Probably because that wasn't his real name. And I would like to think that all of this is behind me. But I came across some fresh red mold in my basement today. And I've been hearing the scratches again at night. I'm not sure what the other side is trying to tell me. But it seems to have the same message it did on Montana. That was a good one, don't you think? I do love something. I love a story that has such a tactile sense to it, as a scrape or a sound, something innocuous and simple, but in the context of things so much more meaningful and mildly terrifying. I enjoyed that. I hope you all did as well. It's been a while since I've been able to share a story with an audience beyond this little hamlet. And I do hope that, powers willing, the radio will maintain its work, the tower will continue to function, Donato will not electrocute himself again, and we'll be able to bring you another story soon. But that's all the time we have now, it seems. Thank you all for coming tonight, and I do hope to see you again the next time we take to the air. So good night, listeners. And please remember, the next time you find yourself stirred from sleep and plunged in the dark, drawn to the darker areas of your home by an ominous creak or crack or scrape, and you remember these words, there's nothing to be afraid of. After all, some of the best things only happen in the dark.
Stories from Dark Places was recorded before an imaginary studio audience. All stories performed on this podcast have express written consent from the original author. Jonas Armitage, his studio manager, and the entire staff of WZHB Radio Innsmouth are fictitious characters, and it's probably for the best that you continue to believe that.